going on inter-registrar transfer policy, so-called ITR, now I can't even remember, IRTP, and this is the fourth in a series of such, known as IRTP Part D, and we're going to hear from, I guess, James and Mikey together, the co-chairs of the group. So over to you guys.
Sure. Thanks, Jonathan. James speaking for the transcript. And Lars, are we queuing up slides, or are we just... can provide a quick overview and some background on this. I will preface it by something that I say at all the IRTP council updates, which is that transfer policies are not the most exciting thing in the world to talk about in ICANN circles, but they are critically important. The ability for a registrant to take a domain name registration from one registrar to another is the underpinning of a competitive marketplace and allows registrars to compete for new customers, and allows registrants to vote with their feet if they're unhappy with the service or price or whatever level of responsiveness they're getting from their service provider. So with that said, this is the fourth in a series of never-ending IRTP PDPs. Fortunately, we were getting, I think we thought ahead by giving them letters, so we knew we could only have 26. But the fourth instance was meant to be the caboose of this series of PDPs, and that all remaining items, including a couple of items that were uncovered in previous PDPs, were moved to the charter of this working group. So can we go to the first slide? Thanks. So this working group had, and Mikey, I'll maybe hand off to you here. I'll just introduce the first charter question, and then we'll just throw over to Mikey as well. We've just completed our initial report. It is out for public comment, and we were addressing several charter questions, many of which revolved around the TDRP, or the Transfer Dispute Resolution Policy, which is an even more obscure suburb of an obscure policy. But again, critically important. If you have a business or service built around a domain name and someone were to take it from you, I think the TDRP would suddenly become a very important part of your life. The first charter question dealt with specifically reporting requirements relative to that policy, and it was I think found during the course of our work that we really did not have a lot of statistics or a lot of data to base our deliberations on this particular policy. So the first recommendation, preliminary recommendations, is that there would be some reporting requirements for dispute providers built into the policy that would be consistent and allow future policy work or really any type of ICANN work to have a solid basis of data on how often this policy is used, and also to establish for dispute resolution providers some base of precedent so that they can use this consistent standard over time. So that's our first recommendation. Mike, you want to?
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. The next one that we... we'll stay on this one for a minute. Let me just amplify something that James said and come at this. There's two sides to this IRTP stuff. There's the competitive side, but there's also the security, stability, resiliency side. And that's always been my strongest interest in this, is how can we make the process of moving with your feet, voting with your feet, if you're a registrant, how can we make that process safer? So that, because it turns out that the transfer between registrars, especially in the early days, had some holes in it. And it was possible for things to get lost into those holes, and it was also possible to exploit those holes to steal domain names from people. And a lot of the questions that this final IRTP is dealing with all of the questions were written back in 2007. So you're going to see that some of them have been overtaken by events. But this one wasn't. This is essentially directed at the dispute resolution providers of that dispute resolution process and saying, hey, you providers, why don't you let us know your decisions? And you'd think that that would be pretty straightforward, but it wasn't included in the policy, and our recommendation is that it be included in the policy from now on. Almost all of the dispute resolution providers do this. We especially were interested in the model that was created in Asia for this, and we're in the details of the report, we're sort of aiming people at that model. So these were recommendations that weren't terribly controversial in the working group. There's very strong consensus around this. And I think, Lars, with that, you can take me on to the next question. The next one is one that's... it dates back to one of the very first ESSAC reports. I can't remember if it's ESSAC 4. If I could channel the spirit of Dave Piscitello, he could tell us the exact number. But the ESSAC, in one of its really early reports, wrote about domain name hijacking. And there are a lot of, and this was in the very early days, like 2002 or 3. Six? That late? Ah. Well, and I don't feel quite so bad. Anyway, it's taken us this long to finally, a little more history about the multi-stage TDR, IRTP working groups. When we wrote these questions and then divided them into chunks back in 2007 or 8, we took the hard ones and we put them consciously at the end, because we felt it was important for the working group to get comfortable and good at dealing with these issues. And back in those days, this was viewed as a pretty hard question. What happens when a domain name has gone across several registrars? It is basically in the process of being hijacked. And what can we do about that? Time has sort of overtaken this a little bit, and so these recommendations don't sound as sweeping as you might think, but it's mostly because other things have happened in the meantime that improve the security of this process. But in the TDRP, so remember there's the IRTP that is the main policy. The TDRP is what happens when the registrars can't work it out between themselves, basically. There are some things that we're suggesting we do. The first one is the recommendation number 3 is that we, well, actually 3 and 4 are together, is that when a transfer has occurred like this, that the domain name go back to the originating destination. In other words, if a domain name is very quickly traversed 2, 3, 4, 5 registrars, and this gets resolved in the TDRP, which is probably where it would get resolved if it couldn't be resolved between the registrars, that then the name go back to the place it started. It's commonsensical, but it's not in the policy. And so we're really appearing. Recommendation number 4 is the payday recommendation there. The one that's highlighted in yellow is the first of a few recommendations that we really want to call your attention to, because one of the things that we're suggesting is that the statute of limitations for the TDRP be extended from 6 to 12 months. There are a whole bunch of reasons for that, but we really want to hear from the community, both the contracted parties and the non-contracted parties, on the advisability of doing this. So that's the reason that this one is highlighted. The working group is in pretty near total consensus on this. We've got some issues, a few minor issues to work out, but you know, we're leaning pretty strongly this way. We want to hear from the community on this particular one. And then the final one, again, we're solidly in consensus on, is if a request for enforcement is initiated under the TDRP, the relevant domain name should get locked while that is being worked out. And again, that's pretty strong consensus in the working group. Unlike the one immediately before it, which is pretty strong consensus, but if you read the report and the details behind this, you'll see that there are some questions that we'd like to hear from people on. James, you want to take the next one?
Sure, if I could just kind of put a button on this one. And this is, you know, we like to, I think, come to ICANN meetings in nice hotels and have very rational, reasonable discussions. But we should remember a few things is that domain names have value. Some of them are incredibly valuable, and there are bad people out there trying to do bad things with domain names. And I think that we sometimes lose track of that, you know, at this level. So the key things here is this idea of laundering a domain name, which is taking a transfer and then transferring six times in a span of 24 hours to obfuscate where the domain name came from and where it was, and then try to thwart efforts to recover it. And the other idea, of course, being this idea of a statute of limitations. I think this is something that we really are looking for community feedback on, because this could have significant implications for the domain name aftermarket, for people who are in good faith selling a domain name or buying a domain name, and then later finding out that that what they were dealing in was stolen property, for lack of a better term, and then later someone else is going to come and take that back from them. So these are tricky issues. It's not something where they lend themselves to immediate resolution. And Jonathan, I'm seeing a couple of hands go up. You want us to just kind of manage a queue over here, or you want us to throw it back to you?
We could take questions now. That's okay. Fine. In fact, if you guys just respond to them as they come, that would be great.
Okay. I just saw Thomas, if I saw anyone else, but Thomas.
Thanks, James, and thanks to the working group for the excellent work that you're doing. With respect to the extension of the statute of limitation from 6 to 12 months, can you elaborate a little bit on why you chose 12 months? Just looking at it from a practical point of view, I've seen cases where domain names were hijacked, but the DNS was left as it was. So it was only until such time when a domain name needed to be renewed that the registrant found out that he or she was no longer the registrant. So since most of domain names are being registered for years time, I think 12 months might not really help, but it should rather be 12 or 15 months or whatever, what have you, in order for to allow registrants to find out and then take the appropriate action when the domain name has to be renewed.
So that is an excellent point, and one of the things that we want to cover we want to tease out in the workshop and in the public comments, as well as the underpinnings of why that extension. I think it's to align it with other periods that we discovered during this work. But I wanted to point out that what you've described isn't a practice that we call hijacking in place, where a domain name is hijacked and control is taken, but the domain name is not moved until when it's aged for, you know, weeks or months or even years in that status, until it's time to do something dastardly with it. So I don't know that this particular recommendation would go to the heart of that particular practice, but it is something that we would be looking at as well. And go for it, Mikey.
Just to expand a little bit on what James was saying, Thomas, in direct response to your question why we picked 12 months, clearly there's the trade-off. Between the impact on essentially the aftermarket, and this can get quite long because domain names are typically now on 2-year, 5-year, quite long renewal cycles, and so to put the envelope around the renewal cycle can get to be quite a long period of time, which at the same time can have dramatic impacts other places. The reason we chose 12 months is because of the annual notification that's required, where a registrant is required to update their contact information and their who is information and so on. And the thought is that if we can make this 12 months, there's at least one clue that a registrant gets, because they don't get that request for the update for their information. And so that's the the underlying rationale for exactly 12 months as opposed to 11 or 15 or, you know, some other number, was to get a period that's long enough to pick up that one minor reminder to a registrant that something's not quite right with their name. Now, I saw Volker with his hand up, and I haven't seen anybody else. Does anybody else want to jump in the queue on this? And okay, so Volker and then Marie.
Actually, Mikey, you just said what I wanted to say, so I want to point out the reason for the 12 months with being the reminder sent by the registrar and giving the registrant a chance to see that something has changed. So that was the underlying thought behind that.
Terrific. Maria?
Yeah, I've got two questions. Sorry, Maria Farrell here. First, I think one of the triggering factors for the PDP was that more people were not using the original transfer dispute resolution policy. Is that the case, and if so, why? And will this help more people to use it? And secondly, as a follow-up on that question, in terms of the trade-off between the, you know, allowing there to be an aftermarket so people can know what they're buying, and people, you know, finding out a year or 2 years later that their name wasn't renewed, is there a way for somebody who is buying a domain name to positively determine the pedigree of that name, so to, you know, to make a positive determination as to whether there have been any disputed or should have been disputed domain name transfers along the way, so that they can have some idea of what they're actually buying?
So I'll take a swing at those. The first thing is that we discovered fairly early on that registrars, in the event of a hijacking, a domain name is taken, the harm can be measured sometimes in hours, particularly for a high traffic e-commerce website. So what we found is that registrars had developed a number of ad hoc procedures amongst themselves, working relationships, where they could pick up the phone and I could call Volker's team and I could say, look, I got a problem here. I think this one looks a little suspicious. And even though we are competitors, we could say, okay, let's set that aside because tomorrow could be Volker picking up the phone. So let's work out a reasonable standard or trust level to work quickly to reverse any transfer where it's obviously on its face, it's been a hijacking. I think that what we found was that the formal process, the TDRP formal process, is used very infrequently. The number was 70 times over the last 10 years, most of them occurring in just one or two registries. So it is incredibly rare, and that will come up again here in later charter questions. To your next question, I think that that is something that a lot of various third-party services are attempting to construct, and there are a number of tools available on the internet. But right now, I think for folks who are heavily involved in the domain name aftermarket as a vocation, are doing that level of research and analysis on their own to ensure. And I think that a number of the aftermarket marketplaces platforms will do that on the intake of domain names to make sure that their inventory is on the up and up. But it is. It is a problem. It is something that I think people in all slices of the marketplace have to be diligent against. And then Mikey has some more thoughts on
guys,
that.
Guys, just a quick reminder on time. I'm conscious of the need to permit questions and get through the material, but we're already slipping behind schedule, and we're only in our second session of the day. So,
Berard was ineffective in keeping me to time limits. Well, just a real quick point to Maria's, and then I think we can zip on to the next one. We have another question in our charter that asks whether there should be more access to the TDRP given to registrants. And to the extent that your question was, are registrants going to be able to get more access to that? Let's hold that for that question, because we tackled that one head on. I just wanted to put that one on.
So if we can go to the next slide, and we'll go into hurry-up mode. Oh, we have another question from Alan. Sorry, go ahead.
Just a very quick comment, and I'll say I am a member of this working group, albeit a passive one. It strikes me, listening to this conversation, that when we were soliciting volunteers for working groups, we could describe in reality what it's about well, we would have a lot more participants. Because this is a rather dry subject that didn't attract all that many people, but there are people who are interested in it once they know what it's really about. So just a thought for the future.
Yeah, the names are not always descriptive. Okay, so we can go to the next slide here. This is whether or not that rarely used policy, the TDRP, should be accessible directly by registrants, or if it should be a registrar-led policy. And currently, a registrant must ask a registrar to initiate a TDRP if they are concerned about a transfer. We spent probably the bulk of our time as a working group on this question, not only maybe 40% of our time frame discussing this issue, and I think that we came up with a couple of very important recommendations, the first being that we believe that the dispute resolution for the TDRP process should be left as a registrar-initiated policy and not opened to registrant. There are a number of missing pieces of information that registrants may not have, that the TDRP or the IRTP is a registrar-to-registrar policy, and so registrants may not have all the visibility to all the necessary steps to effectively dispute that. They do need a registrar to initiate that policy on their behalf. However, we have a couple of other recommendations here, most notably that a previous policy, IRTPC, had envisioned a inter-registrant policy process, and that that process should have a registrant-initiated dispute mechanism. And that finally, that and this is, again, one of these complexities, but there are two levels to filing disputes, the first one being at the registry, so, Verisign or Afilias would have its own policy, and then that it would go to an independent policy like NAF or the Asian Dispute Center. And what we are recommending preliminary as a working group, what we'd like feedback on, is the idea that the registries should not necessarily have to be continue to maintain that policy, particularly when so many of them are not using it. And it could open up to potential inconsistencies when we're dealing with an ecosystem populated by hundreds of TLD registries. So those are the recommendations around that charter question. And we've got Chuck at the microphone.
Bet the audio folks will catch up with you if you just start talking, Chuck.
Yeah. Or maybe just grab a seat at the table.
Having trouble pushing the button.
There we go.
I'm getting old. I just wanted to point out on number 8, I thought of a couple weeks ago when talking to Barbara on your team that there's another possible reason for doing that, and that is with vertical integration. You could actually have a situation where a registry is doing a dispute, serving as dispute provider for one of for themselves.
Good point. Maybe we need to get that captured in our comments. So,
and let me just wrap this one up real quick. I'm sort of on the consumer side of this argument, and I have been through 5 or 6 years of these working groups and was pretty adamant that registrants, if a registrant is confronted by a recalcitrant registrar, they ought to have the option to kick it up a level. And I am convinced by the arguments that we've had in this, arguments not in the negative sense, but in the positive sense. I simply didn't understand the process correctly, and that this is entirely appropriate. So I think we can go on to the next one, and we probably, Jonathan, are we over time now?
I apologize. We are now. We're 5 minutes over scheduled, okay. But you guys did start late, so just bearing in mind, we set you off late, but if you could still try and keep it as
I think we can. Let me blast through a couple, 3 more questions here, and then I think take one last round. So hold your questions. We'll blast through the remaining ones and then pull any burning issues out of the group. The next one was about information available for registrants being provided clearly so that registrants know what their dispute resolution options are. And just a very brief editorial comment. The information that's on the ICANN website is very, very good if you're a policy person and you want to understand how this policy works. But if you're coming to the ICANN website as a registrant, trying to figure out how to get your dispute resolved, it's awful. And so these two recommendations are really just aimed at improving the way that this information is made available, the way that it's written, and making it clear, and collaborating on ways that registrars can then help promote that information. So there isn't any controversy in these. They're not in yellow. We think they're great ideas. We all agree. And I think with that, we'll just carry on to the next item, because I think we've got one more that we... I thought we had one more yellow one in here. We'll see. The next one's about penalties. And again, we are saying, no, not in policy. And in fact, in the second of these two recommendations, we went so far as to say penalties should not be embedded in policy. And again, this is a bit beyond our mandate, but back when this was written, the policy itself had penalties, or it was contemplated to put penalties into the policy. And with time passing and RIA 2009, RIA 2013 having been written, this sort of general notion that there isn't an all or nothing, there's now a gradiated series of responses to policy violations, a whole bunch of reasons that are all in the report. The working group is very comfortable with the idea of no more penalties that are IRTP related, and in fact, no penalties in the policy, and in fact, no penalties specified in policies. Let that penalty structure be defined consistently across the contracted parties, not within policies themselves. James, you want it?
We'll just roll through it, but just that commercial providers really need that consistency, and I think it makes sense. Go to the next slide. Okay, the next two are fairly quick here. They were actually kicked over from previous IRTPs. The next one is whether or not the almost uniform or universal adoption and implementation of EPP AuthInfo codes has eliminated the need for FOAs, which is a form of authorization for transfers. We looked at this, and I think as a working group, we determined that yes, 95% of domain names, maybe 99% of domain names transfers, will not need the FOA. It is superfluous. However, in that small fraction of transfers where something goes wrong, the FOA is essential to being able to undo that transfer or to justify that it should remain in place. So we have, as a working group, we're recommending that the requirement to get an authorization remain in place. Not really controversial at this point.
And let me just add one thing, and then we'll go on to the last question, and that is that the FOA is also being a bit overloaded by certain registrars in their internal systems. And so even if they had been totally eliminated for other reasons, we left this in here for essentially backward compatibility as well. Last question, and then I think we're...
Mikey, I think this was the last question.
Oh, it was the last question. Oh, good. Okay. Well, so now we can deal with all the scrunched up eyebrows around the room and see if there's a cue, and if there's not, we're done. Chuck? It's coming.
Chuck Gomes from VeriSign. Let me compliment those that stuck with this group all the way through. I'll be brief on this because I know we're late, but the transfer policy goes back to way before the meeting in Shanghai when it was first initiated, and it had been stuck for, I think, a couple years. And it broke loose there, and this review is of that first policy. And several people have stuck through this the whole time, so I really compliment you on that. And then I thought I'd end with an encouraging note. I think we must be ready for another policy review for this.
Yeah, but we're going to do numbers the next time. Thanks, Chuck. Jonathan, I think unless there's anybody else, where it's back to you. I don't see any other hands. We're done.
Thank you, and I'm sorry I had to push you for time a little bit, but well done for getting through that and taking the questions that we needed to. So if we could stop the recording on